Won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
And welcome to this hour of We the People at 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, WPFW Washington. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and it's a pleasure to welcome you in this hour. We are a jazz and justice radio station due to entire listener support, and we thank you for that. And this hour of We the People is a news magazine that reflects often one-to-one interviews dealing with race, politics, history, and culture, where they intersect, where they leave us a legacy, and what people are doing now to make a better world for all of us. Our guest today is writer-director Omar S. Camara. He is a first-generation Sierra Leonean American, a Virginia native, a graduate of William & Mary, and the American Film Institute, also known as AFI. Our discussion engages his debut feature film, African Giants. It won the Audience Award at its world premiere at the Slam Dance Film Festival 2024. His film, African Giants, provides the basis of our conversation and is part of the new African Film Festival. It will be shown Thursday, March 28th at the AFI Silver Spring Theater. WPFW is the media sponsor of the festival. Mr. Camara, good morning.
And good morning, David. It's a pleasure.
So I'll tell the listeners, your film's set in Los Angeles. It deals with two brothers who are first-generation Sierra Leonean Americans, and they try to navigate the changing dynamics of their relationship and the society and expectations that surround them. A little bit more about your background. This is a debut film. With all due respect, sir, you would be considered a young filmmaker, but you are an award-winning filmmaker. I know that you won an award for a film short called Mass Avenue. Might you even mention that by way of introduction here?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, yeah, I'm originally from Virginia, born and raised. I'm originally from Woodbridge, and now, you know, live right outside of Springfield. Well, my parents live right outside of Springfield. I'm in Los Angeles now. And yeah, I think, you know, I applied to film school, and I got into the American Film Institute, which I was very lucky about. I actually don't think I knew what it was. I didn't know how storied it was until actually I got the interview request, and I was like, let me do more research on this. And I was like, oh, this is like a really big deal, which was, I was very proud and excited to be a part of. And so I moved out here and started making films, and the entire time was just trying to make films about like my West African upbringing. You know, I was born here in the States, but inside of my household, it was a very West African household with the principles, the food we ate, all that stuff. And so I've been making stuff about that. And so my thesis film, actually Mass Ave, is about me and my dad. And, you know, all my work so far has been sort of autobiographical. So, you know, you add narrative structure and you add these things to it. But it's been about, you know, things that have happened to me that I'm trying to process and come to terms with. And Mass Ave was about my dad and I, something that happened to us actually in Washington, D.C. That's the Mass Ave we're talking about there. And then, you know, African Giants is about me and my brother. But all stuff just me, you know, trying to understand my culture and myself, but doing it through film.
So what should we know about Sierra Leone? And the Sierra Leone, first, the American connection.
Yeah, so yeah, both my parents are from Sierra Leone and West Africa. And I think what's so interesting is, like I said, I was raised in a household that was very apparent of that. Like my dad and my mom were very good at always saying, you know, you are the descendants of chiefs. Like our family is chiefs in Sierra Leone. Like you have a responsibility to this place. And what's interesting, David, is I actually have never been to Sierra Leone. And wow. So that's something that's in a lot of my work too, is like, how can you feel such a part of this place because of how you were raised, but you've never actually stepped foot there? And I actually went to, I've only been to Ghana in Africa, and I went there for work actually. Film took me there. I got hired to shoot something over there, but I have not been yet. And so it's always been interesting, you know, to have siblings, to have family that lives there, to be hearing about it. You know, my grandmother still lives there, you know, having these people I talk to live there, but me not being there, which has created a whole host of challenges and conversations I've had with myself about identity and where I fit and where I belong. But yeah, both my parents are from Sierra Leone, but then I was born and raised here.
Okay, and you noticed a little inflection in my initial questions, because I wanted to make a distinct question. You grew up in Virginia, you went to school in Virginia. What was some of the things you noticed about Sierra Leonean descended folks relating to African Americans?
You know, I think what I learned, and some of the stuff I talk about in the film, is that there are, you know, I think it's the best way to say it is like that Black people are not a monolith. Like, you know, just because you're Black doesn't mean you're the same as every single other Black person in the world. Like, there's very different experiences, very different expectations set on you. You know, just very different ways in which you behave. I actually grew up, you know, in school, actually kind of being teased for being African. Like that was a big thing for me. And a lot of times by, you know, my African-American counterparts, which was, you know, it's in the film. So it's something that, you know, I've moved past, but I think it still affected me at the time. But then in vice versa in the film, I've also witnessed some Africans have some not so pleasant things to say about African-Americans. And that was something that was, I think, very interesting and also very, I think, painful for me. And all that stuff really came to a head for me because, you know, there's a part that's about, a fiance who's African-American dating this guy who's first generation African. And that's based off my real life. My fiance who I met is African-American, met her at William & Mary. We've been together 9 years now. So that was a very personal and real thing that I put into the film because it affected me at the time. I guess it's still affecting us now, but at the time it was like a big deal.
Well, you made reference to the film. They're two brothers, Alaji and is it Shaku? Is that the right pronunciation? Shaku?
Shaku.
Yeah. And these two brothers have to make their way through American society and grow up. And they're fully men, but they still have questions about who they are and what place that they're in. Tell us, without me forcing you to give away most of the film, what's the pretense here? Like, I can say that the younger brother is coming out to visit his older brother in Los Angeles, and if you can take it from there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think for me, there's something that's so interesting. Me and my siblings are very close. I'm one of four, but my little brother, who's 3 years younger than me, is kind of been like, you know, my road dog and all of this. Like, we went to William and Mary together, so we were at school together, and then, you know, just have spent a lot of time together, very close. And when I moved to LA, it was the first time that there was like a distance between us, just because we weren't always together. And AFI is very, very intensive. So that first year of AFI, you're pretty much gone the entire time, just working, making films, learning in class. And so my brother, well, you know, we weren't talking as much. And so when he eventually did come to visit LA, what's funny is that's a part of the film that isn't autobiographical. He came to visit LA after I had actually already made the film. Like, so he came to visit LA after I'd shot the film. But basically, when the little brother comes to LA, without spoiling all the film, he comes with a secret that has to do with his career path, which is he's going to be changing his career path. And the older brother, who for reasons that maybe he doesn't process at the time, is very averse to that. And so the film is kind of a discovery of him understanding why he's averse to that, what he's being defensive about, what he's saying and what he's not saying. That's always been stuff that's interesting to me with siblings, familial relationships, is how much resentment comes from not saying something that you really feel, or withholding it, or saying it in an incorrect way. And so we explore a lot of that in the film.
Family relations, aren't they wonderful?
Yes, they're wonderful. Like, you know, all my films are about that. Like, all my films are either about me and my dad, me and my brother. I'm writing a project right now that's it's mainly focused about me and my sister. And I find that that's actually been the most universal. Like, people after seeing the film have come to me and go, oh my goodness, you know, this film is exactly like me and my brother. We're dealing with this. It made me want to call my brother. That was one of the best reviews I had after Slamdance. Someone who I did not know walked up to me and was like, can I show you something? And she showed me a text. And in the text, she had texted her little brother and said, I love you. And the little brother said, why did you say this? And she said, I just saw this film called African Giants, and it just made me think about our relationship. And so I just wanted to text you and say, it made me emotional because she showed me the text. Like, you know, sometimes I was like, well, maybe she's just saying that. But she showed me the text, and that was really impactful. That's why I still remember it. It was really impactful.
Yeah, and I could testify to the same after seeing the film.
Thank you.
So there's a family context. There's a relationship between these brothers. Is there anything you want to say about the uniqueness of the Sierra Leonean immigration experience?
Yeah, you know, there seems
to be a lot of momentum behind them. A lot of, I won't say baggage, a lot of stuff.
Here's what I think is interesting about that, David. Is like, I think, you know, it's that situation, you know, not to say corny, but like the thing where the more specific, the more universal. And so what I mean is, yes, I wrote it about Sierra Leonean experience and coming here, but I find that a lot of people who are child of immigrants are dealing with the same themes. And I had Chinese immigrants come up to me, Korean immigrants, like people come up to me afterwards and say, I haven't seen this representation on screen of just like how tricky that is to be dealing with this culture from back home, but then be dealing with, you know, the Americanness of what you believe and what you think. And so I think for me, I'm talking about my experience, but I think it's really an experience that goes much, much deeper for people whose parents are just from another place. And I think a lot of it is, you know, when your parents get here, they're like, you're American now. All the sacrifice, this place is like, you know, the land of dreams and land of all these things. And so you're trying to navigate, you know, the sacrifice that they have given up to give you this opportunity. But then also, yes, I understand that I owe you something. And yes, I understand that I appreciate all that you've done for me. But I also have to figure out my own path and also have to figure out the steps that I take, you know, as a man, as a creator, all these things. And so I literally just like download these real things that have happened to me, real conversations I've had. I think one of the first seeds of the screenplay for me is the scene where the brothers are talking. And this is based on a scene with me and my brother. And the last line of the scene is, are we bad Africans? And that scene is one of the most, what'd you say?
I was saying, what did you mean by that?
You know, what I meant by that is I'm someone who is very proud to be African, right? But I don't every day live in a way that is tied to the African continent or affects the African continent. And I think what was interesting is that, you know, that situation that I had was a real situation, which is I was talking to a cousin of mine in Sierra Leone. And he was asking me, like, how's work? And I was like, oh, work is good. You know, I was complaining about it. And he said, well, oh, the work that you have there is real work. The work that we have here isn't anything. And he was like, it's really, really hard here. And I didn't know what to say. Like, I think there's also like a guilt that comes with that sometimes when stuff like that comes, because I'm like, you know, I didn't do anything to be born here in the U.S. It was all decisions made by my parents, and I was born here and just have, you know, had this different experience. But when to hear him say stuff like that, I'm like, I don't know what to say. I'm trying to figure out how to relate and be authentic and not feel like, you know, don't talk, you know, don't say these things that you have no understanding of. And so, you know, it's funny, Dave, I don't know if I'll ever be able to get over that, or if I'll ever be completely at ease or comfortable with it. It's an intricate thing, like I said, because you're tied to it, but there is also a distance. And so I think I put it in the film because I don't have an answer. And I put it in the film because I don't know how to deal with it. And kind of with my films, I like to just present this thing, like, this is the thing that's bothering me. And a lot of times it turns out it bothers other people too. So it starts a discussion, but I don't really know the answer to that or how to fix it. It's just my experience.
Well, what was your relative imagining that you had real work? And if I caught it right, he had hard work. Well, can you put some flesh on that?
Yeah. No, I think the understanding is like, from what I've been told a lot about the experience there, particularly like in the village where my family is from, is that there's not that many jobs. So it's not like there's this, you know, bustling market for people to go and work and make six figures and do these things. So there are people who are working in the government and making good money, working in these other things and making good money. But this person particularly was a teacher of mine. He's a teacher in this rural village, and there wasn't that much income coming from it. And so I think what he was saying by that is like, you know, you're in the U.S., you have your minimum wage and you have these things. And so you're able to make money and do these things. But I'm here. It's not that he's not trying. It's not that he's not looking for opportunities. Not that he's not. But there aren't, from the particular village, I don't want to make it like seem like it's Africa as a whole, but the particular village from where we're from. Yeah,
they're major cities in Sierra Leone. Yeah. As well as bigger, other African countries, whether it's the West Coast or other parts of the continent.
Absolutely. Exactly. So I wanted to make that distinction clear. Like in Freetown, there's more jobs, but where we are and where my family is, there's much less work. So to me, when he's saying, you know, you have that real work, he's basically saying you have this opportunity to make meaningful money that's able to change the course of your life, live you in a different way. And here I am. The work I have here is really hard. I'm working, but the work I have here is really hard.
And so, well, first, let me reintroduce you. You're listening to We the People right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. Our guest is Omar S. Kamara. Mr. Kamara is the writer and director of a film called African Giants. This film is set in Los Angeles with two first-generation Sierra Leonean American brothers who navigate their changing relationship, but also society, values, and expectations that surround them. Thank you for joining us, and let's continue the conversation. So the two brothers, and you can, again, reintroduce them. It seems early on in the conversation, it's about the money, the hustle, and having an edge over and above making a living. I think they complement each other, but there's also, you detect an undercurrent of a conflict of values. What is the money signifying? And it's really not the money, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I think you're 100% right. And I think for me, it's very interesting because the money signifies an opportunity for and a chance for bettering your life, right? So I think, especially for me, when I was at a point, I was at a point where I was trying to, you know, right after film school, like you said, I think earlier you were like, you know, congratulations for staying out in LA. You know, right after film school, like trying to be a writer director is like not a real, it's not a viable financial path. You kind of have to figure it out. And so I was living very economically. Like I kind of was like, you know, that's actually where that base is from. Is like he's living off $1,500, $1,400 a month, which in LA is not that much money, and trying to figure it out. And I think, you know, it was at that same time that people in my life started to make like these large lump sums of money that to me is like, I was like, you know, I had never known a friend who made $40,000 in the summer. That's actually based off a friend of mine who did that and who also was interning at Georgetown and made that kind of money over the summer. And so I think when the brothers are talking about this, like it just signifies that you've made it. I think when you come from a background in which, like, you know, it might not be that much money in the home and all these things, like the money is nice, but it's a signifier of I'm being compensated for the work of all the years that I've put in. And so I think they both have, you know, different, like you said, perspectives on that and different understandings of that, of what money means and whether money is the most important thing in life or there are other things that are the most important thing in life. And what's interesting too, David, is like, you know, like I said, it's mostly autobiographical. Me and my brother have really had these conversations. Like, what's more important, just making money, or is it important? What's more important is it what's making you happy? What are the things in life that actually you should go for? And again, I try not to answer that question. I don't know if I'm right or if my brother's right, but I know that that's like a real conversation we've had. And I know that when we started to come into terms with these types of money, the conversation around them changed our relationship forever, particularly in terms of how that money could impact our family. Like, you know, how that money could help mom, help dad, which is, you know, a line in the screenplay. And so then, you know, that money is, like I said, it's more than just what you're making, but now I can help my family for generate, you know, help things and pay back that sacrifice. But it's, you know, do you have a responsibility to do that is a question that a lot of people have.
Well, mom and dad of this family, they're not really in the film except for a brief moment. You do see a glimpse of the younger brother being celebrated by mom in a dance of joy. Or maybe it's both of them. I've got that confused. But
you know what's funny, David? That's my real mom. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah, that's my real mom in a video that I took of her in my first apartment. And I actually I didn't know I was going to use it in a film, but it like they stick with me. And when my mom came to my first apartment, she was so excited. It's my first apartment out of the house. And that was a real video of her dancing, in my apartment. And so I decided like, let's put that in the film, like, you know, cause it means something to me. And so we put that in the film for the little brother. But I got distracted. What was your question?
No,
you
were talking about my mom. It was joyful to find that out. I wouldn't have realized it unless you told us.
Yeah.
Parents have a way of, even in their absence, being very present with us. We hear their voice inside our head and inside our spirit. I just wanted you to reiterate what the character's mother offered them, what legacy, what it was more than just a motto. It was an ethos, a way of living.
Yeah, correct. Absolutely. You know, it's funny too, because again, like I said, it's like, It's all just real stuff. Like, you know, my mom actually said, like I said, the village we're from is Fatigou in Sierra Leone. And my mom really did coin the term from Fatigou to Hollywood. So that's a real thing that my mom said to me. And she said that to me at a time basically when she was very proud of what I had been doing and what I had been going for. And she was like, you know, I cannot believe that what she said was, you know, her name's Myrma. She said, Myrma Kamara's son is in Hollywood? From Fatigou to Hollywood. Like, she couldn't even fathom, you know, that I was in LA and doing these things. And I think what's interesting is I have two very strong parents, two very distinct parents. You know, my dad is much more of a traditional, you know, you're supposed to be a doctor. That's how you live your life. That's how you make sure that you take care of yourself and your family. And my mom always became this wonderful safety net for us, where we had this very strict father. My mom was very strict too, but she had at least an understanding and an empathy and would allow us to, like, I understand you want to do this thing that's different. Go ahead and do it. And I'll kind of protect you sometimes from the, you know, the wrath of your father, what might come down from your father. And so I think she represents the softness of that and understanding that, yes, you can go for something and it's a little bit against what we are, but like, I'll support you. I'll be there for you. I want you to be successful and pursue your dreams. Cool. And to them, you know, both brothers love her and speak kindly of her, but one brother is still dealing with his stuff with his dad. And I think, and maybe this is answers your question, but a different question. When I came to AFI, I had an interview and I got interviewed by a man named Peter Markham, who's no longer at AFI, but he's like been such a touchstone of my life. And in my interview, he said, every filmmaker has one story they're telling. Your story is the story of you and your father. And it was interesting to me, David, because I did not tell him that, like, the film I made was about two brothers, was like a very domineering, overbearing brother. But what I didn't tell him was that film was actually about me and my dad, But I just did it as a brother because I, you know, I could cast a younger actor and all these things. But somehow he saw through that and knew that this was like, you know, a through line, something that was vibrating very deep with me, this relationship between my father and I. And it's funny, one of the conversations I've been having after the film is like, you know, the mom, at least you see, but the dad you never see in the film. And some people say, it's so interesting to me that you never see the dad in the film, but he is looming so large over this, the relationships and their decisions. And I think, you know, it wasn't even, I can't even say that it was intentional. I just think that, to go back to what you said, everything that I do is an offshoot of my parents, how they raised me, you know, the things that they did that was really impactful for me, the things they did that was very hurtful to me. Like, I'm a walking, like, reaction to the way that they live and the stuff that they, you know, imparted in me. In fact, the undisclosed locations in the films, those little monologues in the middle, are real lines of dialogue that my parents have said to me. Like, you know, one says, you know, I want you to build an African dynasty. That's real stuff that my parents have
said
to me.
That's your mom who said that.
The mom said, yeah, yes. And that was really, she said that. She said, and, you know, she said, we came here so you guys could live a better life. So all the sacrifice will be worth it so that you can build an African dynasty. My mom says that to me all the time, like all the time. And it's been very nice as I've started to turn the corner in my career. And I say started because, you know, it just has begun, really. But to see the pride in her from believing in me before anything was going on. And now things are happening. The feature is getting traction. My shorts are getting traction. Like, you know, that stuff is getting traction. And to see the pride, because that's all she wanted. Like, she wanted to know that all the things she was sacrificing when we were growing up and we were kids and, you know, we didn't have that much money and we're trying to figure out would be worth it. And so me and all my siblings are now kind of moving into like these phases of our career that I think are making her and him very proud, which is like the, you know, a great joy for me.
Well, I hope they and some of your relatives can catch African Giants. Again, WPFW is the media responsible of the film festival called the New African Film Festival, which is located at AFI Silver Spring Theater. That's downtown Silver Spring, Maryland. African Giants will be shown on Thursday, March 28th. So folks, you can make a plan to catch that film and some other films during this week as well. Again, the New African Film Festival, facilitated by our colleague, Moisa Mutali, who's the producer and host of Africa Now, along with James Pope. And a shout out to Kisheri and Funa and Patricia and others who helped facilitate that festival. So you truly participates. I get to greet you, the listeners, and thank you for listening to We the People and to WPFW. Omar, if I may, don't want to neglect a missing piece here. So we talked about what your mom instilled directly and the older brother, and you can repeat the names of the younger and older, and we'll try to get people intrigued in the characters. But the older brother repeats the mandate and urging that the father left the two brothers. What was that about being the best?
Oh, yes. And that, again, really for my life, my dad said, you know, if you're going to be a street sweeper, you have to be the best street sweeper you can be. And that was something that, like, he grew. That's the quote you're referring to, correct?
Yes. You're right on point here.
Just making sure. Yeah. And that was something that I heard so many times growing up. And in fact, the line where he, I think in the film, it says, you know, if you're going to be a street sweeper, be the best street sweeper you can be. He said, when I was young, I remember hearing this over and over again. And that's kind of something that always I was hearing, and was actually very, you know, it's at the time very grating on me. But now as I'm older, I realize how impactful it was, because I think it was just being applied to the wrong thing. At the time, I was actually like, of course, you know, like many.
You're a younger person. That's a lot of pressure, man. It's just that simple.
Exactly. And I was actually going into, my dad wanted me to be a doctor. So I was actually doing neuroscience and studying all those things at school. And I absolutely hated it. Like, it was just like my brain did not work in that way. And my dad was like, it's just because you're not applying yourself. Like, if you apply yourself, if you work hard, you know, if you got to be a street sweeper, you got to do all these things. And I was like, okay, I'm hearing it, but like, it's not clicking. And what's interesting is, like, you know, my dad was very averse to me becoming a filmmaker, which that's another line that's in the film. Like, when I told my dad I wanted to be a filmmaker, I'll never forget, I went home and I had actually already moved out because I was actually working for the College of William & Mary at the time. So I got hired and was living in Williamsburg, was working there. And I came home to tell my dad, and you have to do it. You know, it's African culture. You respectfully. So I made sure the stage was set. You know, he was eating his food. And I said, Dad, I know what I want to do. I want to be a filmmaker. And I remember, I can still see it. He was sitting at his table and he was eating his rice and his spoon was hitting the plate. And he said, if there's one thing you need to know about me, I have a very strong will. And if I never have to talk to you again, I'll never talk to you again. Wow. And he got up and we actually didn't speak a word to each other for 6 months after that. Like he was serious. Like he didn't know though for that time. And that really, really, really affected me. And it really affected, it's actually in both of my movies, in my short and kind of it's in my future, because it affected me and it impacted me at the time. But I think that was something that stuck with me. But I realized that later, my dad actually gave me all the tools to be successful in a career of filmmaking. The problem was he just wanted me to apply it to like sciences, which is not what I was. But I used the street sweeper quote all the time. Like, you know, I'm always trying to be the best filmmaker I can be, and to learn and to grow and to be better. Like, I'm always using these things that he said. I'm always thinking about trying to build this African dynasty and make their sacrifices worth it. It was interesting the switch that happened, you know, once I started to do it and apply it to something that I love as opposed to science.
Listeners, you're listening to We the People right here at 89.3 FM, WPFW Washington, also at WPFWFM.org. The voice that you're hearing is that of Omar Kamara. Mr. Kamara is the writer and director of a film called African Giants, which reflects the lives of two Sierra Leonean American brothers set in Los Angeles. It's part of the New African Film Festival that is supported in sponsorship by WPFW that's going on right now at the AFI Silver Spring Theater. We're at the halfway point of our show. We need to take a little break in service to you. We'll bring you some public service announcements, and I ask you to stick with us and rejoin the conversation. We will certainly find out more of this interesting experience and reflection. Stay with us, won't you?
Celebrating 20 years, the New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project, brings the vibrancy of African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora to the DMV at the AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 15 to the 28th. The festival features 26 films from 16 countries, including 3 years premieres and discussions with filmmakers. Explore the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa at the 2024 New African Film Festival. Tickets and full schedule at AFI.com/silver. That's AFI.com/silver. Or call 301-495-6700. 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But more importantly, let's focus on our guest, Omar S. Kamara. Mr. Kamara is the writer-director of a film we're featuring in our conversation, African Giants. It's about two first-generation Sierra Leonean American brothers who navigate the changing dynamics of their relationship and deal with society, expectations, and values that surround them. Welcome back, Mr. Kamara. Thank you. So, you know, so we're talking about really having a life, having agency, having movement through life by the engine of our parents, the engine of our identity, the engine of our community. And it becomes a good mirror to see that on film and the story you tell the two brothers. I think anybody who's going to sit in the theater and watch this film is going to see some strong reflection, receive some strong added value to managing with their life, whether they're young gentlemen like the two brothers or whether we're up there in years. I think the film does that service, and I thank you. If you can remind me of the two brothers in their distinct points of view, I would at least start out with this. The younger brother recognizes the differences that they represent. He says something to the effect that we are different from Western culture. You know, in reference to his parents, he says their priority for us was food and shelter and not necessarily hugs and kisses, even though I suspect those characters received that, at least from mom, if not from dad.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I love that. And that was also, again, another real conversation I had with my brother. I think the difference, the main difference between the two brothers, Elijah is the older brother. I think Elijah is kind of operating off pure emotion. So he's operating off just how he feels, what he feels in that moment, whether things feel good or bad, and just responding to it. I think Sheku, the younger brother, is much more logical. He's able to sit back and reflect and to not just react off his first instinct, but to sit back and reflect and kind of, you know, put that through the, you know, life and other people's experiences. And it's so interesting because the brothers are kind of written as, you know, as me and my brother, but it's funny. They're also almost, I found, me at two different points in my life. Like, I think, you know, I used to be very much Elijah, which was because I'm a very emotional person, going off the impulse and the feelings and all that stuff. And as I've aged, I've actually found I've been kind of getting closer to Sheku in terms of understanding, like, hey, you know, this thing happened. It was painful, but like, people are people, and you can understand and process and have these conversations with our parents to kind of find a common ground, which I'm very happy that I've done now. Because now, you know, like me and my dad, it's funny because if you watch my films, I think a lot of people would be like, oh, he must not be close to his dad at all. But we actually were able to reconcile after a lot of these things that he's seen me and have conversations about it. Actually, after the events of Mass Ave, which is my short, that moment that kind of changed our life forever and made us have some conversations that we did not normally have. But I think that's the difference in the two brothers. And I think in that scene, you know, the younger brother, Sheku, is smart enough to realize, like, just because they loved you in this way does not mean that their love was invalid. It just means they have a different way of loving. And I have to tell you, David, I didn't realize that until I was like 26, 27 years old. Like, most of the time I was like, man, this is just like, you know, I watch TV and I see people's parents making the milk and cookies and I don't really get the milk and cookies. Like, this is a very different way. But my parents had a different mandate and a different things they were trying to accomplish, but they loved each other. They loved us in a very, very strong way. They just showed it in a different way. And a little highlight I'll give to that is, so my dad said, I'll never speak to you again. And then after 6 months, what he did was he would start talking to me, but through my mom. Like, he would get my mom to like, can you send him something? Do this, do this, do this. So for someone who said he had a very strong will and would never talk to me again, he couldn't actually do that. Like, he's that involved. He wanted to be a part of my life and he wanted to. And now what I'm happy to say is he's like the biggest fan of my filmmaking career. I actually couldn't afford to fly out for my interview. And my dad paid for me to fly to the West Coast for the first time for my interview. Wow. My dad is now, he calls me all the time. He's like, what's going on with the film? What's going on with African Giants? You know, he actually even offered to give some money for African Giants. He didn't end up, but like, there was one point I was stressed.
So was he listed as a producer or?
Right, exactly. And this is a guy who said he would never want to talk to me again about new filmmaking. And he so believed in what had happened since then. You know, I think my short got licensed by HBO and he saw that I was going for it and really not giving up. And you know what he told me, David? He said, eventually we talked about it. And he said, I don't even remember telling you that. Like, I don't remember saying I'll never talk to you again. But what I'll say is, when I was in Sierra Leone and I came here to be a landscaper, my driving thing was, I'm going to have 4 kids. They're all going to be doctors. And that's what he was working towards. So he was like, when you said that, it wasn't that I didn't want to be supportive, but I kind of felt like the dream that I had and what I'd been working for all these years was going away. So he was like, I didn't mean to say that, but it's what I said. But he goes, also, I just was scared for you because the percentage chance of making as a filmmaker, especially someone who's Black or African and does not have these ties to the industry, is very, very hard. And so I didn't want you to have to go through that. But after he saw that, like, I'm going at this thing with reckless abandon, like, he saw I was going for it no matter what. Now he's been like one of the biggest supporters, which has been great.
Well, that's fantastic. He's a big man in a good regard for doing that. And I like the fact that little brother in the film also, he so smoothly reflects that maturity and that being able to look back and not just analyze, but really understand with the mind and with the heart. And I guess it's just an illustration, you know, parents, they try to be responsible to their children and they try to stretch their imagination, but the world's very frightening and ever changing. And so they have to take that imagination and stretch it around a changing world. Again, not giving away the store, but kinfolk can inform each other about this changing world and work together. That's all I'm going to say about that for now. I want to return to something also, with Elijah, since you've put it out there that there's a representation of traditionalism in his and kind of like the absent father in the film. You can see that he's aware of some things and not aware of others. But one of the things he's aware of is in celebrating how he and his brother grew up, just how important it is to have drive, especially if you're going to try to not only boost or encourage a relative, but to really help them. And younger generations would say he has the hustle. He knows how to hustle. But but I think there's also a contrast because he talks about some of the religious practices that he did as a kid. And he had a great deal of pride about that. And with those practices, he seemed to understand in growing up that that was going to be fuel for the adult he was seeking to become. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting because, like I said, like all my everything that I am is because of my parents. So like all this stuff that was distilled in me is that's what's giving me my drive, my focus, the stories they've told me about how hard they had to fight to like come here and to be part of this country and put us through school and make us do these things. So that was always like very present in my life. It was always like, you know, I don't think I take my life and the blessings that have come to me for granted. And so because of that, it's also on the other hand, like, okay, well, that's the case, that I need to make sure that I make something of this, that I work hard, that I hustle, as you say, to try to take advantage of the opportunities that were given before me. But I also think, you know, to answer your question, the part with religion was another thing that was kind of me dealing with something that was impactful to me, but I don't have the answer to. Like, I keep, you can tell, I keep presenting these questions in the film and not answering them specifically. But I, you know, both my parents are Muslim, and that was like a very big, you know, thing in my life. But then they actually sent us to a Christian private school. And they did that because it was like the closest thing to us, and they thought it would be, you know, good education and all that stuff. But that was very confusing for me because I was raised in a Muslim household, and I would go to school and go to chapel and go to church and go to all these things. And it actually kind of caused me to pull away from religion a little bit. And now I've been finding my way back to it, but to pull away from it because I was just confused by these two like competing ideas. And I kept thinking, like, I'm seeing both sides of me. So I can't believe that one side of this group of people are going to hell. Like, both of these people seem like they're both trying to do the right thing and move forward. And so it's interesting that so many of those tenets, though, it's the same thing with my dad. Like I said, we have a different way of thinking, but so many of those tenets I use and apply to my life. I feel the same about religion, even though I pulled away from religion a little bit. There's so many of those tenets about the type of person I want to be, the type of man I want to be, that I still use and apply to my life and apply to, like, you know, try to be the best man that I can be.
And in the brothers having their dialogues between each other in the scenes where they're alone, talking about such things kind of keeps returning to this question. Earlier you said, I forgot which brother, younger or older, but they talked about growing up and being teased. And I really lamented that maybe older people could have told them, especially with the Pan-African theme of this show and with Africa Now, someone should have told youngins not to really tease each other in such hurtful ways. But the question I was alluding to, that they keep returning to, remembering their past, talking about this impulse and these changes, is they keep asking, are we Africans? And I can't seem to interpret it in the film as, how can we be Africans in a more positive, affirmative sense?
Correct. And that's kind of what I was saying earlier, is like, how can I be like an ambassador and a steward for Africa in all of my life? How can I be in touch with my culture more? How can I be in touch with my family in Africa more? How can I be fully lived in this experience, opposed to, you know, feeling very American sometimes? And that scene you're alluding to, David, is like a very, that's like a, you know, kind of sometimes to me like a hurtful scene to watch. Because, you know, it's me saying the truth about the difficulties of, like I said, being stuck between two places. And, like, you know, the older brother says, you know, sometimes I listen to African music, just African music. Like, it's all I listen to, nothing else. And sometimes I'll just stop and just listen to hip hop, like just straight hip hop. And, you know, he's like, why? Why? He's like, I don't know. It just happens sometimes. You get into these phases and it happens sometimes. And the other thing too is like, there's been definitely a shift that I've witnessed in my lifetime of, you know, don't talk like African booty scratchers. We don't want to talk about Africans. That's not interesting. That, you know, like I said, hiding my Africanness. To now, there's been this beautiful resurgence of, you know, going back to the culture, you know, going back to Ghana, people finding their roots. You know, like I said in the film, now Wizkid and Burna Boy are popular at the festivals. Burna Boy selling out Madison Square Garden. These are African filmmakers that are African musicians that 10 years ago would not be in the limelight and the spotlight and getting the radio play they're getting now. So that's been interesting, too, of like, I know what it's like to be teased and to be called an African booty scratcher and made fun of for being African. And then now it's like, let's celebrate Africa and celebrate all these things, which is great. But it does create this dissonance for me where I'm like, well, that's weird. I have a lot of wounds that I was being made fun of for being African, and now it's being celebrated. And so I just wanted to put that feeling in the film, and because it's a complicated feeling. And so I just wanted to touch on that because it's something I think about a lot.
Well, allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Omar S. Kamara. Mr. Kamara is the writer and director of African Giants, his latest film. It's award-winning. It made its debut as a world premiere at the Slam Dance Film Festival of this year and won the Audience Award. It's also making a debut in this area at the AFI Silver Spring Theater in downtown Silver Spring, Maryland. WPFW is an official media sponsor of the New African Film Festival, in which African Giants is a part of. The film will be shown on Thursday, March 28th, and I would encourage you, since I've seen it and have worked with the festival, to take in this film and understand film and story making and narrative and the life and experiences of the African diaspora. You can also do that by regularly listening to Africa Now with friend and colleague, producer Muiza Mutali. That comes on through the air broadcast at 1 p.m. on Wednesdays, but it's also available on SoundCloud and social media platforms like iTunes and the like. And many, many of the 80-some-odd WPFW programmers who bring you jazz and justice throughout the week, put their shows on social media platforms, and you can check our archive at wpfwfm.org. Let me do this before we get to our closing, Omar. Coming up next during the noontime hour during the week is Don't Forget the Blues. The Wednesday edition is brought to you by Clarence the Blues Man Turner. To keep you abreast of what's going on in the world, 5 minutes before the hour, starting before noon and up to, I believe, 5 and 6 o'clock. If you tune in right before the hour, 5 minutes before, you get the news from our News and Public Affairs Department through Chris Banger-Drowns and Sue Goodwin. And I'm going to give a shout out to Mike Nasella, our engineer for this hour. Thank you. So I wanted to deliberately bracket the last 3 minutes or so that we had to close out the show. This film is altogether wonderful. It's poignant about the relationship with these brothers. And again, I've done my best in trying not to give away the store. I hope we tickle people's curiosity and interest. I hope that sustains them enough to find themselves at AFI on Thursday, March 28th, or to take in the rest of the festival going on now at the AFI Silver Spring Theater. What do you want folks to take away from the film around family, but also just the experience of these young gentlemen? How are we to interpret this? What is it that you want to leave us with?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I would hope to leave the audience with is just this idea of complexity, in that things are not as simple and as black and white as they may seem. And a lot of times that means how our family has impacted us, things they've said to us, But it's not just this black and white thing. In fact, if you talk with them, if you take the time to understand them and to try to reach them, you'll find that there's much more nuance and gray area to what they were talking about. And so I think with that being said, it's fun. You can, you know, they deal with a lot in the film. They fight, they go through these tensions, but you can tell at the end of the film that I am somewhat of an optimist. I'm someone who believes in the power of human beings and relationships. And like I said, my brother is like one of my best friends on planet Earth. And so I think what I want to take away is that these relationships are complex. They change over the time. Your relationship with your family might not be the same as it was when they were younger, but it's worth it to fight through that stuff and deal with all these things, because I just think family is one of the most important gifts that life can give us. And so I think to acknowledge that complexity, but to also, you know, fight through it and to love, I think it's worth it.
And strategic reiteration here, family ties are not easily broken. They're just not easily broken. And the film makes that clear. I wanted not to neglect that on Thursday, March 28th, you will be here for the question and answer section of the film. And we should make that very clear to the audience.
Yeah.
There are a number of films, not all of them, but a number of films will have either the producer or the writer or the director. And that's one of the joys of the New African Film Festival. You actually get to see and hear what people are trying to do with these films. We've got about a minute or two to go. Again, you can have the last word. Again, I'm being quite deliberate about this because if I could translate the joy of seeing this film through this hour, I hope I've done that job. And again, I think, I mean, you mentioned a wonderful theme, but, you know, we often neglect that family and kinfolk that are right up under us do want to help each other. It's not all about fighting all the time. And you made that clear. You sustained that throughout the film.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think sometimes, like I said with my dad, that fighting can come from them trying to protect us. Like, they're trying to protect us, but in a different way that they know how. But I just want to say thank you to you, David. I appreciate you taking the time to watch my film. It is my debut feature, so it's my first time making a feature film. And the reaction to this film has been nothing short of a blessing, especially when I'm taking a very personal story and, you know, talking about these themes that are personal to me and saying, you know, will people react? Will there be an audience that reacted? And, to have your reaction and the audience reaction to win the audience award with such a personal film talking about these, you know, themes that are like I'm dealing with in my life has been the greatest joy. And so I can't wait to share it with the DMV area. I'm really excited to be back home.
And you caused me to catch something. There's the identification with family. There's the identification of African identity. There's the identification with Black identity writ large, at least here in America. But
yeah,
you've contributed, my compliments to you, in a sense of Pan-Africanness that anyone can enjoy. And I thank you for that. So Omar Kamara, thank you for being with us in this hour. It's been a pleasure. And I do hope people get to enjoy your film.
Thank you, David. I really appreciate it.
All right. And that winds us up for another edition of We the People. Listeners, tell a friend, tell somebody, whether it's this show or any other show in WPFW, we need you. We want you to be with us. We want to be with you. We're trying to build a better world, better communities, one broadcast at a time. We can only do that with you, but you should hear me say emphatically, thank you for supporting the station. Hopefully we'll meet again next week over the radio. Take good care.
our blood, our sweat, leaves us to our tears. More, lawmakers cry. And in the name of brotherhood, the rivers run dry. Shall not stand down. We'll not be your clown. All the flame burning bright. Perilous night. Perilous night.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, March 20th. Here are some headlines. A Republican-backed Texas law that would allow state law enforcement authorities to arrest people suspected of illegally crossing the U.S.-Mexico border was blocked again just hours after the Supreme Court yesterday cleared the way for it to go into effect. The Supreme Court did not rule on the merits of the law, but allowed Texas to enforce the measure pending an appeal. Late last night, the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals put the law back on hold ahead of oral arguments before the court scheduled for today. The Biden administration argues that Texas is overstepping the federal government's immigration authority and has challenged the law as unconstitutional. Civil rights groups have argued it could lead to civil rights violations and racial profiling. In other news, President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, both of whom had already clinched their party's presidential nominations, picked up more delegates yesterday in their respective primary contests in Arizona, Florida, Illinois, Kansas, and Ohio. In another highly watched race in Ohio, Bernie Moreno won the Republican U.S. Senate primary and will face the Democratic incumbent Sherrod Brown in November. That race could determine which party takes control of the Senate. Trump had endorsed Moreno, and the primary was this year's first test of the former president's clout in a contested Senate race. Alabama Republicans gave final approval yesterday to a bill that would not only ban state funding for diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at public universities, local boards of education, and government agencies, but also would limit the teaching of what Republicans call divisive concepts surrounding race, gender, and identity. Under the legislation, divisive concepts are defined as assigning fault, blame, or bias to any race, religion, gender, or nationality. The legislation, which would take effect on October 1st, now heads to Governor Kay Ivey, a Republican, for her signature. And in international news, the White House is expected to meet with an Israeli delegation early next week to discuss alternatives to Israel's plans for an invasion of Rafah. An estimated 1.5 million Palestinians, over half of Gaza's population, have taken refuge in the city after fleeing fighting elsewhere in the territory. Earlier this week, Biden warned Netanyahu of what could be a humanitarian catastrophe if the invasion takes place. Meanwhile, Netanyahu appears determined to move ahead. Yesterday, he said he made it clear to Biden that there was no way to eliminate Hamas without a ground incursion in Rafah. The White House has said it will not support a Rafah operation without the Israelis presenting a credible plan to ensure the safety of Palestinian civilians. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned of a gigantic tragedy should the invasion move ahead. The health ministry in Gaza said today that at least 31,923 people have been killed in the territory since the conflict began 166 days ago. And in weather today in Washington, it is 62 degrees, partly cloudy. Cooler conditions are expected tomorrow, with daytime temperatures